A few weeks back, the soles on some of my shoes came off. These are shoes that I still like, so I didn't want to let them go. I didn't want to waste the money, and I didn't want them sitting in a landfill. Problem is, I don't know how to fix shoes. Actually, I don't know how to fix pretty much anything. I can make do like a champ when things aren't working, and I know how to replace them when they're too far gone, but fixing things isn't something I learned. It's not what our consumer culture teaches us to do. Well, there's a growing movement of people who think that needs to change, but plans for fix-it workshops here in town keep falling through. The most recent group isn't doing it because of liability. The sticking point is, if they teach you how to fix your laptop and then your house burns down, what then? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about why we don't fix things, why that matters, and what can be done about it. I've got two guests for that discussion. Kyle Weens runs a website called iFixit. He's joining us from San Luis Obispo in California. Hi, Kyle.
Hi there.
Explain what iFixit is.
We are an online community of people teaching each other how to fix all of our stuff. So we've got instructions that have been created by the community on how to do everything from swap out the battery in your iPhone to how to fix your toaster if it breaks.
Is that any kind of toaster?
We get very specific. So it'll get down to the specific model. We have general instructions on like approximately this is how toasters work. But then a lot of times with some of the smaller kitchen appliances – the real trick is getting them open. Once you get them open, the repair is usually really easy.
What do you see as like the need that this is filling?
Well, it used to be the default that if something broke, you fixed it.
When was this? This is before my time, I believe.
I would say this is our parents' time.
Okay, go on.
I would say all the way through the 80s, this was just the expectation that you could fix things. And for me, there was a sea change moment with the VCR in the 80s where that was the first mainstream gadget that we were all buying that was when it broke, you call a repair shop and they would tell you it's more expensive to get it repaired than to just buy a new one. And that mantra has kind of permeated society now. But it's flat out not true. A lot of modern televisions will fail. You could have a really nice 50-inch LCD TV that works fantastic, and one day it just stops turning on. Well, the part that fails is a 5-cent part. And if you can open it up and replace that little tiny capacitor, the TV will work for another 5 or 10 years.
But can I jump in and say a lot of us see our money in terms of not just dollars, but hours, because those two things are interchangeable for many people. So if you have to spend hours finding out how to fix the thing before you fix the thing and potentially break it, and I'm just speaking on behalf of myself as a very unskilled laborer in this sense, that is where it starts sounding very expensive to me, is in the time and possible breaking, needing to pay for the new thing anyway.
Absolutely. I think that's totally reasonable. And that's where the internet comes in. It has never been easier to learn how to repair things. There are some things, like my toilet was leaking the other day. If you think about the process of hiring an expert to fix your toilet, you're gonna look them up on Google. You're going to find a couple plumbers. You'll schedule them. You're going to have to take some time off work and sit around and wait for them. The overall amount of time that it will take you to book and caretake for a plumber to come to your house is substantially longer than if you just went down to the hardware store, bought the new part, dropped it into your toilet, you'd be done in 20 minutes. The problem is you don't know how to do that. And so that's where you get on a site like iFixit or on YouTube and you look at other people that are doing it and you see, wow, actually like almost all toilet repairs are trivial. They're really, really easy.
Is the liability thing a concern for you?
We help millions of people fix things every month on iFixit, and we've never had a major lawsuit. This is, I think, something that is a little bit overblown.
Imagine lawsuits.
I think we imagine lawsuits. I think there is a element of personal responsibility that we understand these things. I think also one thing, when you start fixing things and you start to understand how things work, you realize the likelihood of your laptop burning down your house is very low. There isn't any high voltage circuitry inside your laptop. So the more that we understand how things work, the more I think we can be part of proactively mitigating that risk.
Okay, I'm going to come back to you and your story, but my other guest is Sean Egan. He is a volunteer mechanic for the 816 Bicycle Collective, where they take old bikes that people were just getting rid of anyway, but then they fix them and get them into the hands of people who really need some form of transportation. Hi, Sean.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So first of all, how did you develop the skills you need to fix bikes?
Really out of necessity. After I was 21 or so, I went on a long bike trip, and after 9 days and hundreds of miles, realized I should probably know how to do a little bit more than fix a flat. And so I got back and got a book and started reading, and turns out I'm not the only interested person. Found other people, and turns out a lot of people want to fix their bikes. And it just kind of started there.
Did you find that, I mean, have you found over the years, I guess, that most of the bikes that end up in your hands are basically still just totally good if you have even the most basic mechanical know-how?
Well, no. But I guess I guess that on average, they're all pretty much, I mean, to what Kyle was saying about how, or I guess as you said in the opening, like the consumerist sort of ideas that are propagated, like people promote buying a new bike, people throw a bike away. I mean, just waiting in the lobby, I was talking to somebody about how they got a bike for their son by posting on a website and somebody gave them one. It was nearly brand new. They're made, they go to the landfill a lot.
Why do you think that is? I mean, do you think that is usually because people perceive that something is broken about them, or is it something even more basic than that?
You know, I mean, for bicycles specifically, I feel like, they're much like cars, they're produced to be put out every single year. It's an expectation of consumers of cycles in general.
One.
It's like, oh, what year is that? I mean, that question assumes that we all understand that they're made every year, which is, I mean, kind of a fundamental issue itself.
So when you taught yourself how to fix a bike, you did that using a book. And that intrigues me. That, because to me, part of the deal with fixing things and doing it or not is not just a matter of the specific skills. Because as we've already heard, like, even if you're just talking about toasters, think about all the models of toasters. And then think about that toasters are just among the many, many things that can break that you would need to fix. It's not exactly a matter of already knowing all the skills, but having the confidence to feel that you could acquire them and then carry them out effectively. And I lack that basic confidence. Therefore, I could read a book and I'd still be like, I don't know. I'm probably going to electrocute myself if
I
do this.
Beyond the book, I mean, a book goes so far, and then practical experience. And I was lucky enough in my formulative years of learning about bicycles to have a resource that Kansas City lost a while back called Acme Bicycle Company that used to be in the Crossroads on 18th Street. And the ladies that ran that place were an invaluable source to me and a couple of the other people who began the bike collective, and they would just let me hang around and bother them until I basically had enough skills to apply myself at a bike shop. So, I mean, practically, yeah, you need to find something probably more than a book. I mean, I heard a story on the radio the other day about how people spend a lot of time watching YouTube videos on how to do stuff, but don't actually do it. So yeah, I mean, it took the hands-on help from the ladies at Acme to like give me the confidence to actually go and apply at a bike shop.
But you need some modeling.
It helps. And you know, YouTube was not a thing then so much as it is now. So I the book I had was from the 70s and black and white.
Yeah. Maybe they needed a new one that they should replace the old one with. Just kidding. Kyle, I want to bring you back into this. What was it that inspired your whole story? I mean, not just fixing things, but fixing things as an evangelical kind of movement. Kyle, are you there? Okay.
I'm
Kyle's here.
I was working on my computer when I was in the university, and I dropped it onto the power plug, and I broke it, and so it was one of those things where it was clear it was just a loose connection inside, and so I figured, well, I can open this thing up and just solder it back together. It's just a loose connection, and so I went through the process of starting to open it, and I realized I had no idea where the hidden latches and tabs were. And I think this is a situation many of us have been in. You start to open something, you're like, how do I get this thing open? And so I started Googling for the service manual, and I couldn't find it, and so I went through and I did it the hard way. And I eventually got it fixed, but it was much more challenging than it would have been if I'd had any kind of reference or information. And so I decided, well, I'll just open it up again and take pictures and post them online. And that was really the beginning of this kind of addiction to teaching people. But what was interesting was I did some research and I said, why wasn't the service manual available online? I know that it was an Apple computer. I know that Apple writes service manuals. And I learned that the service manual had been posted online, and everyone that posted it had gotten legal threats from Apple demanding they take it offline. And I learned that this is part of a trend that many, many companies are using copyright law to prevent people from knowing how to fix their products.
So then, I mean, the problem of our ability to fix things and our sort of habit of doing it or not, it's not just about our individual choices. It's partly about, like, this is kind of not how our economy works right now.
Right. Repair requires an ecosystem. If you have something that breaks, you got to know how to fix it. You got to have the part to replace. You got to have the tool to be able to get it open. And that is an ecosystem that used to exist. And it's not particularly challenging to create it for any given product, but you multiply across the dozens of types of gadgets that we all have in our home. And if the manufacturers are going beyond actively helping people be able to fix their things to actually starting to interfere in that system, if you pull one leg out of that stool and you make the information not available, it really hampers the repair economy.
Well, let's bring our listeners on this. You can call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation if you have a story about learning to fix things that might inspire us, or maybe it'll just add a different perspective from what we have been hearing. 816-235-2888. I want to talk to John in KCK. Hi, John.
Wow, great show. I am just actually about a mile from the bicycle cooperative. They've moved from Troost over to the current location. But every single thing, from my historic buildings to my historic homes to my vintage sports cars to literally everything other than food, which we still get at the farmer's market, our bedding and our leather, all of it is repurposed and has been restored. And every single thing was done by myself or other craftsmen. And I, for 10% of the cost of new stuff, I live a life of inexpensive luxury. And we just look at other people in this materialistic feeding frenzy, throwing out actually good quality old craftsmanship or good well-made things to buy this cheap disposal stuff. And you're right, the corporations bet on it. Let me give one more example and I'll stop talking.
I get the lifetime
warranty brakes at O'Reilly's, and I'm not plugging them, but they expect you to change your car every 3 years. I've had my same work truck now for 15 years. I've gotten 12 pairs of brakes replaced for free. Okay. So I'm like, why would anybody buy a new vehicle with the price of a mortgage and pay outrageous taxes and insurance, or you can buy an older vehicle that's easier to maintain, low insurance and taxes, and you get lifetime warranty parts. So I'm glad you had this show, because we are just amazed at the throwaway generation that's coming behind us. And also, if you learn mechanical skills, it increases your functional intelligence 10, 20, 30 points, literally.
Literally. Okay. Well,
literally.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
You know, I want to get some feedback on this from Sean, because Sean, you're kind of knowingly chuckling, especially I noticed at that line of a life of inexpensive luxury.
Yeah. I have definitely found that my life has changed a lot at the realization of there being so much trash, you might call it, but I mean excessive waste that our society sort of promotes and capitalism sort of promotes. And I mean, basically, capitalism just doesn't age very well if you look around, if you go to the landfill, if you look at everything. And I have everything and more than I need. And when I think about, like, I don't know, say what, I mean, what this guy's referring to is inexpensive luxury. It's like, yeah, I have what I need. for sure, and then some. I mean, probably too much, and I definitely don't. I definitely don't work as hard as I think I'm supposed to for it.
What do you mean? You mean like put in the hours?
Sure. Or? Yeah, and you know, back to what you were saying earlier about if you think about your time as money, like a lot of people do, and then you think about the social cost to buying new things, it kind of puts into conflict the idea of cost benefit or social cost benefit. And I think our society's moved quite a ways away from the idea of the social benefits that we need as a society to get by and more toward just a cost benefit analysis. But as it's been noted before, like, we can't eat money and we need to sort of work with what we have.
Let's talk to Melissa. Melissa is calling us from the Plaza. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what is your story about fixing something yourself?
So I have kind of an old car that is reliable for the way that it runs, but not much else. And when I got in it the other day, the handle, the inside door handle, just snapped off in my hand. And I was like, I don't even know where to start. Do I take it to a mechanic or a body shop? And even just the thought of having to figure out how to fix it was really overwhelming. But I talked to a coworker about it, and he just treated it like no big deal. And so he told me you can get the replacement part on Amazon, and then you can just watch a YouTube video. And so that's what I did. I got a replacement door handle for my 2001 Corolla on Amazon. It cost $7. And then I just looked on YouTube, and yeah, plenty of other people had done this before. And I watched the video and I was like, okay, I think I can handle this. And I went out to my car with my screwdriver, and the whole thing took maybe 10 minutes. And
so $7 and 10 minutes.
Yeah. I felt very powerful.
Wait, so talk to me about that piece of it, because I do think it would be very, aside from useful, empowering to feel like I can just fix things.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I just felt so overwhelmed at first of not even knowing where to start, or, you know, especially as a woman, and there's that stereotype of women getting taken advantage of at car places. And so I was anxious about that, and who do I trust? And so when I found out I could do it myself, I trust myself, and I knew I could handle it.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Melissa. Kyle, talk to me about this.
Well, I think this is really typical. It's amazing how you have one little tiny broken thing and it undermines your faith in your entire vehicle. And I had that. It's something very similar. Just the plastic bracket on my door handle broke, and I went down to the junkyard and got a new one. And like, I've never had to worry about that door handle ever again.
So you walked down to the junkyard. So
yes, junkyards are pretty cool. If you've never been to one, you go in and you tell them your vehicle, and they say, okay, down, you know, at row 5, the third car down is the same car that you have. And just go and see if you can find the part, and if you can, you know, pull it off the vehicle, then we'll give you a good price for it. It's really cool. So you go down there and you're like, okay, there's the same Honda Civic I have. It's a different color, but the inside's the same. And, you know, it's one screw. Let me take the door handle off, and then I'm off to the races.
Do you do this too?
Oh, definitely. And I just wanted to point, Melissa was saying she felt powerful. And I just want to point out at the Bike Collective, like, one of our missions, our goals is the words empowerment through education. Because when you can fix your own things, when you feel more sustainable as an individual, it puts you in a more empowered situation. And it makes you feel, I mean, less oppressed by all of the complicated technology that we are basically forced to use in our lives to be part of the society.
Let's talk to Matt, calling us from Baldwin City, Kansas. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Hey, I really feel very passionately about this issue, and I really like what your guest just said about capitalism not aging well. I have watched KitchenAid dishwashers since the 1960s go from something that would last 30 years or more to something that, with a consumable part that is expensive to replace, that lasts only about 5 years. And I was appalled. And I feel a kind of a sense of moral outrage when some of these things are designed and engineered to bare minimum, needs and fail quickly. Recently, I completely tore down and replaced the heat exchangers in my HVAC furnace with some online support, with online help. And I want to just echo what the guests are saying, that is really a thing.
Your house climate is comfortable?
Yes, it is, and everything works fine. I was extremely methodical. I put all the little screws from every little phase of the disassembly into labeled plastic bags, and I consulted the exploded view diagram that I downloaded for that particular brand and model. And it was methodical and time-consuming, but I was able to do it.
Yeah.
And I was able to find the new, very important parts that were the main guts of the thing from an independent HVAC dealer in Parth over in Olathe. So
very cool.
I was able to do that and save myself about $5,000.
Well, thanks, Matt. Before we go, I do want to ask Kyle, are there words of caution that you have, even a cautionary tale, perhaps, as people who might have been convinced by this conversation to try fixing things embark on perhaps their first rodeo?
Well, I would just say start with something easy. There are so many repairs in our lives. Like we're fixing a toilet is really easy. And it seems dirty and gross, and it's really not that bad. And so I would say, you know, dip your toes in. People always ask me, you know, I want to replace the battery in my iPhone. Is that something that I should feel confident that I can do? And I say, look at the instructions, pull it up on iFixit, look step by step at everything you're going to be getting in for, and then make the decision of whether you're comfortable or not. But I think you look around at the world of all the things that you have, find something, it's already broken. The worst that happens is it stays broken.
Yeah. Kyle
Weems.
The
best that happens is you fix it.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Sean Egan with us from the 816 Bike Collective.
Thank you.
Up next, work to live or live to work. Not new questions. Characters in literature have been wrestling with work about and what it says about them forever. The Bibliophiles will join us shortly with great books about work. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're joined by the Bibliophiles. They join us once a season to recommend great books. This time around, we asked them to come up with a list of books about work, and not just how to succeed in the workplace type books with the newest tips and advice, but actual literature with characters defined and made more human in part because of what they do and how they feel about it. I have some favorite examples of my own, and I'm sure you do too. Call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. The Bibliophiles are Katie Stover of the Kansas City Public Library. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Gina.
Mark Luce, he teaches English, art history, and writing at Barstow and KU. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
And Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, a freelance writer and book critic based out of Topeka.
That is correct. Good to be here.
So before we dive into everyone's recommendations, as you started thinking about this topic of work in literature, are there ideas that kind of surfaced for you that you might not have really put into words had you not been focusing on what books am I going to talk about and why?
I immediately had a list, but I call them occupational memoirs, and I had a great time putting together a list of all the books about the weirdest, oddest jobs that I had read over the years. So I have some old titles with me today, and then I have some of the standard ones, like what it's like to work in the hotel industry, what it's like to work in a restaurant on the back of the house and the front of the house.
But can I say that an odd job, odd is totally in the eye of the beholder, you know? Like, why do we call some jobs odd, and why are we curious about some professions enough to read books about them, whereas others, like, maybe not?
Well, I think people want to read about jobs they could never, ever hold. Like, what is it like to be a mortician or a crime scene cleaner
or Steve Martin?
Or Steve Martin, right?
Oh, how aspirational. Yes.
Could never hold that job.
I'd love to.
Okay, so anyone else? Just thoughts that kind of surfaced?
Well, I was surprised at how many novels I could come up with. I thought I would be just like nickel and dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich, but there were a lot of novels that I wanted to talk about in terms of work, so that was surprising to me.
I didn't even consider nonfiction. I went straight novels and started thinking about how does, you know, there's not really a novel about a job, right? They're about a character right. who happens to do something. And so
but
I started thinking about
how we define
work and what work actually means and how a job influences sort of the characters. So I kind of had fun by thinking about different books. I was like, how does this relate to work?
So can you give me a favorite example of some character from literature on your list who gave you a little bit of an insight into the answers to those questions?
I think Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest. It's one of my favorite books sort of in general, but I never think of it as a workbook.
Okay, right? What's it about?
So the Continental Op, who's a detective for Pinkertons, he shows up in a town called Personville, but they call it Poisonville. And he's supposed to meet with a newspaper man, and the newspaper man ends up dead instead of getting to their meeting. And the newspaper
problem.
Man's...
That's a problem.
The newspaper man's father is sort of the boss of the town, and he ran a mine. And a couple years before, there was a strike, and he brought in strikebreakers. And so basically, the strikebreakers came in and took over the town. So you've got guys that run numbers, bootlegging, all these different kinds of things. He wants to get rid of them. The old man does, hires the op, gives him $10,000 and says, clean up the town. And so he does. And then the novel's written in first person. So the novel's actually his work report to his boss about what happened.
Whoa.
But it's all
novel in the form of an incident report.
But it's not. Yes. I mean, it's a really cool novel. It's not really the incident report, but that's actually what you're reading. And I think, too, that the whole thing's predicated on mining and the strike. And so there's this undercurrent of labor that kind of goes throughout.
It's like
and
part of the setting.
It's the whole setting. I mean, that's why he's in the town. And all these bad guys come in to take over these sort of little parts. So, you know, guys are like, I'm the bootlegger. I'm the numbers guy, right? I'm the loan shark. And so it's really kind of interesting when you start thinking about gangsters and work. And so that's why, and then mixed with sort of labor history. So that's kind of why I went with Hammett and Red Harvest.
Very cool. Mark and Jeff, you have both recommended A Manual for Cleaning Women by Lucia Berlin. Jeff, why don't you start us out on that one?
Okay, good. And Mark can chime in or whatever, add a postscript. Lucia Berlin's A Manual for Cleaning Women was published in 2015, and it was a posthumous publication, and it was met with just universal acclaim. Part of it is Lucia Berlin wrote what the French called autofiction, where she takes the events of her life and arranges them into art. And this is art. Spiky language, arresting image. I mean, it is their stories are brilliant. And she oftentimes, as I said, it's autofiction, the characters are stand-in for Lucia, and they work in emergency rooms. They work as cleaning women. They work as emergency room nurses. So it's maybe pink-collar fiction, blue-collar fiction. Lots of the characters are alcoholics and in detox. And Lucia Berlin herself was an alcoholic who sobered up and then became a beloved professor at University of Colorado at Boulder. And the title story is absolutely brilliant. And Mark and I talked beforehand. I think he wants to talk about that story.
She... one of the things, I came to her sort of late. I didn't really know of her. And when I read the first part of this collection, I immediately thought of Raymond Carver. The people are blue collar. They're sort of down and out. It's somehow spiritual and depressing and uplifting all at the same time. And it's a little more lyrical than Carver. In thinking about her, I can think of two other authors that I would put in the same category with her, and that's Dennis Johnson and Carver. Mm-hmm. It's just the way in which you structure these people who are kind of down and out, but they're not worthless. And they don't think of themselves necessarily as worthless. I think one thing you could say about her, she's like a poet of the afflicted. Like these people in her stories are broken, but they're kind of okay with that.
Wait, can you say more about that? Kind of okay with it? How do you
get
that sense?
They're not self-loathing. You know, I think a lot of times when we read fiction about people who are who are worse off, that somehow they're broken or not whole, or they're just striving for something more rather than just being sort of individuals.
I think you're absolutely right. She doesn't write with the hint of condescension. She understands because she's been there, but she pulls art out of it. I mean, I was just knocked. It knocks my socks off, this first collection. She also had a second collection that was published posthumously in December that I reviewed as well.
And a memoir.
So yeah, and a memoir, right.
This is A Manual for Cleaning Women by Lucia Berlin. Katie, tell me about Nine Lives, From Stripper to School Teacher, My Year-Long Odyssey in the Workplace.
This is a great book to give to young adults who aren't quite certain what sort of job they think they're interested in, because you can sample 9 different jobs. Lynn Snowden, a journalist, took on 9 different jobs in her year-long odyssey into the workplace. And she started by...
What does that mean, a year-long odyssey in the workplace?
This is all... She wanted to see what it was like to do white-collar work, blue-collar work.
But in 1 year, when you're on, like, job 4, don't they start saying, like, hey, you keep leaving jobs?
What's great about this book, too, is that there's a chapter at the end that she tells the reader how she got all these jobs.
Okay.
And what's really fascinating is the toughest job she had to get, working in a chocolate factory. She said, you don't need... And she said what surprised her was she needed almost no credentials to be a substitute teacher. But she had to sign all sorts of privacy papers to work in a chocolate factory. But she worked as a copywriter for an advertisement agency. And she says, I no longer cringe when I hear a bad jingle on TV, because I know that it probably went from a great idea to a poor one based on the focus group and the client's fear of how their product would go over in the public. She talked about working as a cocktail waitress in Las Vegas, and then she went and got a job as a stripper. And she said that you can get licensed for that. You need to get a pole dancing license for that. She worked as a housewife for a family, and she said that was one of the toughest jobs ever.
So she was a housewife for hire.
Yes.
Gotcha.
For hire. I'm pretty certain the mom in that family happily took the month off and just went to a hotel. She also worked as a publicist on the red carpet at the Golden Globes for a young TV star who was in Beverly Hills 90210 at the time. So that dates this book. Brian Austin Green. Footnote, movie stars don't carry cash, but they like to go to the bar. So you have to carry cash and pay for their drinks.
Oh, my goodness.
She also worked as a pyrotechnician for the heavy metal band Skid Row. And they hired her without any experience at all. But she wanted to work in a field that appeared to be male-dominated. She wanted to see what it was like. And what she learned from working all these different jobs is that this newfound confidence that she could learn to do anything. And so she said she worked through all the misogyny that you run into when it comes to handling electronics or heavy machinery or even pyrotechnics. She says she has a brand new nightmare, that showing up in public naked nightmare that she went through while she was working as a stripper. It doesn't bother her anymore. She has brand new. She's like, did it. And so she feels a lot more comfortable with that. But she says, I have brand new nightmares. Your psyche will find new nightmares.
Exposure therapy.
Yes.
But that's funny. So that's a lot of different professions and probably a lot of different epiphanies. Is there one that stands out to you as like, oh, I would have never thought about this aspect of this profession and what it's like to be in this world? Just something that really like sticks in your mind.
Well, this book was published in 1994. And so I read it when it first came out. And more than 20 years later, the chapter that sticks with me, oddly enough, is take it off, take it all off, then put it back on, put it all back on, the stripper chapter. And what strikes me about that one is she writes about all these women, and they have children, and they usually have financial problems, and that's why they go into such a lucrative field. The fact that they take care of each other and that they have to be licensed. I thought that was fascinating that they are. She said there is work that goes into this. There's nothing glamorous, and forget everything you've ever seen in the movies, and that it's what you're seeing, what Hollywood is selling you, is absolutely untrue.
Mark, you have brought in a country doctor's notebook.
Yeah, this book is absolutely hysterical. It's by Mikhail Bulgakov, who went on to write Master and Margarita, which never got published, which didn't get published until like 20-some years after his death. But Bulgakov was a Russian, and he was in... he was wounded in World War One. Was addicted to, got addicted to morphine, and then because he had gone to school, he was appointed as a provincial physician from 1916 to 1919. So he had to go sort of from cosmopolitan Russia to sort of backwater Russia, and the stories in this book are sort of they're fiction, but they're not. So it's his experiences sort of hanging with the peasants. And they, you know, they're pretty backwards, and they apply medicine outside of their clothes rather than on their skin, like an ointment. So he's sort of this lone soldier of reason, and he tries to apply science to what is like kind of folk beliefs. And so some of the things that he deals with in this collection are amputation, tracheotomy, malaria, traverse delivery, and then in a...
But Mark, can I jump in and ask something?
Sure.
So this brings me to what I think could be seen as sort of something problematic about a lot of these books, especially when they're sort of like the voyeuristic romp through someone else's profession and someone else's world, is that the people who write books are often highly educated people coming from a certain amount of privilege. That's not always the case, but it's often the case. And so when it's sort of like taking you behind the scenes among the peasants, for example, you know what I mean?
Well,
like the
yeah.
There's a pitfall there.
But the thing that you realize through this writing is that while he's worldly, he's ignorant. And while he's intelligent, he's actually naive. He thinks of himself as superior, but in fact he is inadequate. He has to learn these things from books. Very funny. Country Doctor's Notebook, Mikhail Bulgakov.
We're talking with the bibliophiles and you discussing literature about the working life and literature that stuck with us about the working life. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. You can also tweet us. We are at KCURCST. When we return, I'll also share some KCUR staff recommendations. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and my guests are Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, and Katie Stover, the Bibliophiles. We're discussing really great books about work. Hi again, everyone.
Hi there.
So I'd like to read some recommendations from my fellow KCUR staffers who have a lot to say about this theme. And first of all, this one may not be surprising at all, but a lot of people who work at KCUR feel strongly about Working by Studs Terkel, which... is a compilation of oral histories, people he interviewed during the Great Depression, and on some level, advocacy writing, I would say, which I think is a category. You mentioned Jeff Nickel and Dimed. I think that's mm-hmm. in that category, mm-hmm. in spite of not being strictly oral history. But anyone have thoughts about Studs Terkel and Working and really its role when we are talking about this theme?
I haven't read it for a number of years, but I was really struck by it when I read it, the authenticity of it, and it seemed very important, compelling at the time.
Yeah, and I guess that it inspires a lot of people who interview others for a living is not at all surprising. But there is kind of a newish book called Gig. That would be one of my recommendations. It was published in the early 2000s, and it's supposed to be kind of an update to Working, but even the change in the name kind of says something, I feel like. Gig is a temporary performance, which does feel very 21st century. Working is like an ongoing state of being. It's like the dot, 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 working on it. You know what I mean?
24/7.
Yeah, they say we're living in the gig economy, but I've done it for years. It's been my life, the gig economy.
Well, my favorite entry in Gig is actually, it's about a florist talking about the reasons why people come in for flowers. And I highly recommend, if you're just going to pick up this book and read one thing, to be truly moved by The Florist in Gig is really beautiful. Each of the entries are like a page or two. Other staff picks include Kyle Palmer recommending Hard Times by Charles Dickens. He says this book has relevant themes in our digital age about how striving for efficiency and productivity saps the human soul and stifles creativity. Nods all around.
Godspeed. Dickens, always evergreen.
We'll get back to some staff recommendations, but Jeff, what do you want to share with us?
Well, I have been going around talking about Severance by Ling Ma to anybody who will lend me their ear, and it is truly a brilliant book. It has a nice pink cover here. Ling Ma was born in China, and then she grew up in Utah and Nebraska and Kansas, specifically, and she finished in Topeka and graduated from high school in Topeka. So the genesis of this book was she was working as a fact checker for Playboy magazine. And then they began downsizing. So she began to write sort of an apocalyptic story during the downsizing. Then she was laid off, and she continued to work on what became this book using her severance pay. And then she went to Cornell and got an MFA and finished the book. And it's absolutely brilliant. It was published in, I think, August of 2018. In October, it won the $50,000 Kirkus Award for fiction.
What do you like about it?
It's a dystopian zombie book. It has a really nice languid millennial romance. The writing is completely fresh. It has a biting critique of capitalism and corporate structure. It's funny, even though it's very grim. I mean, it's just completely surprising.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I loved it.
Severance by Ling Ma.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk to a caller at 816-235-2888. Sandy, what do you want to share?
Well, I'm a late reader of Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain. I was blown away by the multiple dimensions of it in terms of what it takes to be a cook. And it wasn't just about getting good at sauces or that sort of thing. There was everything to do with the high degree of labor, just sweaty, rough, long-hour labor that he was involved in. The other thing that was great was the incredible reliance on a team. And he singles out Ecuadorians and people from other countries as being not laborers, but keen cooks and people he learned from. So that was a great thing to see what the whole team was about. And buying food, and keeping your knives sharp, and how to run a business, and all of the other stories that went with it. It just gave a really, really wide view of the world of what it means to cook in a restaurant that entails.
Thank you so much for that recommendation, Kitchen Confidential. Katie Stover has also brought that in. And Katie, I kind of feel like one of the things is that it doesn't matter what you do. The restaurant is a place that you probably have had some level of experience with, even if it's just walking by restaurants on the street, but that there's this whole world behind the scenes.
I think that's why people like service industry books, because they confirm some of our worst self-doubts, because no matter how well we hide some of our quirks, chefs, waiters, housekeepers, they see our quirky things, even though we think we can hide them.
All of our weird stuff.
Yeah. And I'm glad that Sandy mentioned Kitchen Confidential. I brought with it as a pairing, Waiter Rant by the waiter, who has since revealed his name to be Steve Dublonica. And we had him at the library. And Waiter Rant is about the front of the house, how you still need to work with a team, and what it's like to work with customers there on the floor.
And that anonymous name he gave himself, it started as a blog. He came on the Walt Bodine Show, actually, when I was co-hosting that. And he was an anonymous guest, which we did not often do, but there's stuff that he couldn't have held on to his jobs.
No, he couldn't have. And now he's no longer in the service industry. I think he's still working on that blog. But you learn an awful lot as a restaurant patron, how to behave, how when you make special demands that the waiter will do what they can to accommodate, but sometimes they can't. And
I see this as the anti-Seinfeld, because in Seinfeld, it was always like, he as a customer felt that he was kind of outsmarting and detecting the idiocy of whatever people were doing in the service industry. And this is like, nope.
Nope. I think service industry books want to show readers the humanity of these professions, that service industry workers already know that invisibility and mind reading are their greatest strengths. But that doesn't mean that you don't want them to know that they're there and deserving of respectful, thankful treatment.
So this is Waiter Rant and Kitchen Confidential and as a pairing. And you brought one in that represents your own profession.
Of course. How could I not bring in a book about being a public librarian? I brought in Free for All, Oddballs, Geeks, and Gangsters in the Public Library by Don Borchert. And this one holds a special place for me because, yes, Don Borchert did come to the library when he published his book. But it's also the first accessible book about what it's truly like to work in a public library. And Don was a library assistant with the Los Angeles County Public Library System, and he writes about what it's like to work in a public a branch library. So he talks about the kids that come in after school and the children's librarians who are constantly covered with glitter and all the, he chronicles one student who seems like he's not going anywhere, and because of the work of the library, the student graduates, and the librarians don't see him for a while. They don't see him for several years. And when he comes back, he's joined the military, and he wants them to know how their help and support helped him get through high school. So I have a special place in my heart for Free for All by Don Borchert.
You know, Mark, you're recommending Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng. We interviewed her recently and have an extended conversation with her about that book. So because we are short on time, I will refer our listeners to that. But why don't you tell us about Nightmare Alley by William Lindsay Graham?
This is a forgotten noir book that was published in 1946 or 1947. It follows a fellow named Stan Carlisle, who is a grifter and a con man. And his first time that he goes to the carnival, he sees this guy called the Geek. And the Geek, like, eats birds, but it's also a con. And the Geek does this basically for a bottle of booze a day. And Stan's like, that'll never be me. Well,
famous
last words. He becomes a clairvoyant. And so he cons rich people out of money and telling them like, oh yeah, we're talking to your, you know, dead grandmother or to whatever. the book is structured in that there's 20 or 22 chapters, and they're each one is the name of one of the cards in a tarot deck. So you've got mentalists and hucksters and sawdust, and it's just a wonderfully sort of nasty little story.
Well, it sounds cool. if I want to travel into the life of the clairvoyant in noir fiction, what is the name of this book again?
Nightmare Alley.
Nightmare Alley. And Jeff, quickly, before we go, The Imperfectionists is a title that intrigues me.
Okay, The Imperfectionists by Tom Rackman is about the dwindling journalism industry. It was published in 2010. And
I related to that title for a
reason. If it was relevant in 2010, it is even more relevant now. It's set in Rome in an English language paper in Rome, and each of the staffers gets a chapter, and there's even a chapter devoted to the reader. And he was 35 when this was published. He had worked for the International Herald Tribune and an AP foreign correspondent. It's a brilliant book about the shrinking newspaper industry. I think they had, you know, once been a robust paper, and now they're down to 10,000 as readers and advertisers get poached. Relevant then, more relevant today.
Twist at the end just blew my mind
away. Ooh, but we won't say what it was.
No, we won't.
But there's a twist at the end, you guys. On our way out, I just want to share a few more of KCUR staffers' recommendations. People had a lot of great ideas here. Maria Carter says The Call, the Midwife trilogy by Jennifer Wirth. Basically, it's the tale of a young nurse midwife in a poor area of London in the early 1960s, delivering babies in places where indoor toilets, hot water, and electricity are not taken for granted. Also, she notes, nuns seem like very interesting co-workers. Our office manager, Jeannie Rooney, recommends The Pale King by David Foster Wallace, published posthumously, about IRS agents who are really bored and who worked at a center in Peoria in the 1980s. She says it makes finance and accounting and taxes into black comedy. and she should know. Melody Rowell, our own producer, recommends On Writing by Stephen King. She says it's necessary for anyone who wants to do anything even remotely related to writing. And we'll have to leave it there because this show is over. Bibliophiles, Katie Stover, Mark Luce, Jeffrey and Gowdy. Thank you all.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
You can listen back at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about the controversial micro apartments going in downtown as an option for affordable housing in the area. Is it an option for everyone? That's tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Chris Young, Salisa Kalakal, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.